guys. This is The Conversation. It's episode number 145 with David Hilliard, Boston-based photographer, photographer's photographer, lover of Boston. And we take you into his studio, his workshops, and crits, of which he does throughout the country. And we take you into his father's nursing home, where he has been photographing his father for a while now. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where no better time to take a look at the guest's images, being that they are high-end photos that translate quite well, I would say, as compared to other work. You can check out When Lips and Skin Remember, a shot of his mom in the Christian Southwest, Florida, with husband number three, among many others. And a new thing for you and for the podcast is we're starting a survey, first of several, I imagine, but this is finally the first one we put together. And if you would be so kind as to visit the site and fill it out, it's just six questions. It'll give us a better idea of what your tastes and preferences are, so we can get a better sense of how to mold the podcast going forward. So if you go to theconversationpod.com/survey, again, it's just six questions, should take you about 5 minutes tops. We would really appreciate it. Help us a lot. Ultimately help you as well. What else? I wanted to also let you know that thanks to the switch over to Libsyn, the professional podcast platform that we've used starting late May, we have returned a number of episodes from the archive back into the stream. So in other words, if you go to your platform, whether it's iTunes or Stitcher or something else, you will find fairly old episodes, but great episodes potentially with people including Amanda Ross Ho, Eric Yonker, Jonas Wood was a very popular episode in its day. Los Angeles painter Jonas Wood, quite controversial episode. And David Nemiroff and Mika Marple of Night Gallery. That was a wild episode. So those should all be found now in your podcast feed for The Conversation Pod. So go check those out. All right. I will talk to you more in the back end, but for now, we're going to find out what David Hilliard is all about. So thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you more in the back end. Please stick around for that time, and I'll talk to you then. So you're in Boston right now, correct?
I am in Boston, yeah. That is my home base, and I was born and raised outside, north of Boston, moved to Boston not long after, as soon as I could after high school, and ended up going to college here, and then went to graduate school elsewhere, but traveled a little bit after all of that, lived in Europe for a few years, and but in the end seemed to consistently gravitate back to Boston, which, it's funny, I had dinner tonight with a friend, and we're both from this area, and have traveled extensively, and but there is something pretty great, in our opinion, of course, about the Northeast, both in its landscape and in its mindset and in its our political views. It's just like a good place to live.
Yeah. Where would you say the Northeast?
I guess I'm talking about New England.
I mean, which basically, technically includes New York, but I mean, would you say, culturally speaking, that it's like upstate New York, the Adirondacks, up to Maine, basically?
Exactly. Well, parts of Maine, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Right. Maybe we'll get to that in a little bit, because that's where you're building that house, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, I have been building a house since 2002.
Right. Yeah. So you're talking about this New England / Northeast kind of camaraderie or similar, sensibility or disposition
maybe it's just, and this is the big question. I don't know. It's like, maybe we always just feel wherever you're from in general seems to be the place that you want to stay or come back to, or you understand the mindset of the people, the landscape, the way the air works and the animals that frequent it, like everything. It's just, there's something, and it seems to be the older I get, there's something comforting about knowing a place really well.
Right.
Not to get too touchy-feely about it, but...
Yeah, but
I really know this.
But how far out, where you grew up, how far outside of Boston is that?
Maybe 35 miles. I grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts,
right,
which is, I don't know if Lowell is, for some people, they historically, some people know Lowell. It's
right.
A big industrial
hot
spot with the onset of the canals, fueling electricity. And so it's historically pretty significant, but not currently a down and out kind of place in some people's eyes. But making
right.
a
but
comeback.
You grew up close enough, in other words, that the Boston area, you know, is what sort of in your, it runs in your blood, that kind of thing.
It does.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know it. I mean, I grew up lower middle class. Like, I didn't, it's not like I got to Boston very often. It wasn't until I got, it was a young teenager that I started to actually come here. And but it's the closest large city.
Yeah, that's young enough, I would say.
Yeah,
that's
and
more
we're
than
a burgeoning
enough.
Gay man. Like, it was like I couldn't get here fast enough.
Oh, know? I see. Were you facing some issues where you grew up then?
Yeah, a little bit. Just that I, you know, which is not original anyway. Just I didn't. I was a square peg in a round hole.
Yeah, right.
So had to get out.
Right, right.
And so moved to Boston.
Well, you're the second Boston guest that I can recall, and the other one was fairly recent, Anthony Graney. And
yeah.
One of the things that was a big takeaway from what we talked about was the fact that, as far as the art community, even though it's, and you know, you can address this in whatever way you like, but obviously it's a tight knit community, is my sense. But at the same time, as far as collectors and also by association artists, you know, New York is so close that so many people gravitate there. So is there sort of a pride in the small, modest, but tight-knit community that you'd say you have, or is it really nothing like that?
It's funny that you say pride, because my first instinct was to say no, I don't think, but I think I am proud of it. I don't talk about it a lot, but it's a pretty great place, I think, to be an artist and certainly a photographer. I mean, if you are photo enlightened in any way, it's like there's a lot of great schools and a lot of great artists, photographers have come out of here, and I'm happy to be a part of that community. And both as an artist and as an educator, we're falling all over each other for such a small city. It's pretty remarkable. And like you said, its proximity to New York is pretty remarkable. And I do a lot of work in New York, and so that, alongside of loving just being from here and understanding it and knowing how it all works. There isn't anywhere else that feels as right for me.
You mentioned that you're a photographer, and you kind of could be called a photographer with a capital P, in that your photography in a lot of ways is pretty traditional. And I mean that as objectively as possible, not, you know, putting a value judgment on it. And the reason that I preface all that is to maybe have a little investigation of your, how you would define, you know, the photographic or photography community compared with the art community, because there's certainly a lot of crossover. I mean, I imagine you cross over a lot, but there's more the sort of academic photo world, you know, which persists, and I wonder how much it persists in Boston, versus people who are artists who happen to use photography. You know what I mean? And there's that whole spectrum that runs along that line, if you will.
Yeah, I'll say one thing about Boston. You know, this is like, we are like filthy with colleges and universities.
Sure.
And, I no longer teach full time, and nor do I have to. There's enough adjunct work that, I mean, given my schedule, that I can usually, if I keep my nose clean, pick up classes at, you know, a handful of the schools that I work with. And so I seem to live with a foot, well, many feet actually, in different places. But as far as photography, it is, I make my work, but it's also in tandem with my academic, with teaching and other artists that I rub elbows with. We are often also, we're making work, but we're also educators. And that is, at least from my studio practice, people don't sometimes like that term, but I don't know what
Thank
else
you.
To call it.
Thank you. Oh, you did we talk about that, or is that...
No, I don't know who talked to her. Like, there was this whole... Maybe we did talk about it. There was this whole Facebook thing not too long ago.
Well, that probably came from my show. But you,
I don't
from
know.
From somebody who
oh,
listens
did it?
To my show. Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know what to call it. It is. I have a studio, and it is a practice. It's work, right? So I don't know. So I just out of habit call it that. But
that's okay. As long as you don't use the word anymore, that's fine.
So for me, it works quite well to teach and to also like make my work and. And also there's something about being alongside students that I find like totally inspiring and that keep me on my toes and challenge me. And
well, let me interject, because I think that's a great way to segue in, because you the way that your students are challenging you, I wonder if one of the ways is to say something along the lines of, this is just portraiture, you know, this is just glorified portraiture. So do they say that? And if not, you know, well, say if they do, and if not, you know, you can answer it however you like.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So in other words, the first question is, is that one way that your students challenge you, as, you know, any of your students, because you teach a lot of places, but if you're showing examples of photographic work, whether it's yours or historical photographers, you know, is there at some point some challenge to traditional aspects of photography?
Oh, as without being, a doubt.
Yes,
I mean,
that's what I'm getting
that's
at.
Young person's job, right? To kind of to roll their eyes and want things to be different, and I was like that, and you were probably like that, and one of the things, and I talk about this with my students. There seems to be this fear. I don't know if fear is too strong a word, but this concern about being too didactic or too obvious in their work, or being too illustrative, and that they want their work to be open-ended and to ask questions and not be too literal. And I guess I get that. I understand that. But there's also the downside of that is that we have to talk about the big A word, which is audience. It's like, well, people need to be able to enter into your work. So portraiture, no matter what it is, like in this case, we'll just use that as an operative word.
Right.
It doesn't matter whether it's traditional or abstract or historical or contemporary. You still need to let someone into you need to give them a toehold into whatever however you're shaping it, be it in form or content.
Sure.
And that's often the fun struggle I have with students is like letting them be okay with being, letting us in a little bit and running the risk of being literal or dare I say cliche.
Right.
That's the big thing. Oh my God, I don't want to be cliche. A sunset, forget it. It's like, well, the sun sets and it happens and maybe your camera might touch upon it at one point.
There are pros and cons to both sides, for sure.
Being,
you know, obfuscating what your message is and being really plain spoken, both have their pros and cons, I would say. One of the things I want to ask you about photography and photographers is the associations of it being a very sort of straightforward, disciplined, and you know, and speaking of, you know, round holes, if you will, you know, it's very straight laced, I guess. And that's kind of what I was getting at with your students that we were talking about earlier. And so I guess just to put it really simply, would you say that you specifically you're a very organized person, you know, everything has its place. You know, you have, you know what I mean? The studio has to be exceptionally clean when you're doing, you know, large format, running
there's
a large
less,
yeah.
Yeah.
Go
yeah.
ahead.
There's nothing sexy about, in my opinion, most photographers' studio, you
know, right.
unless it's some kind of, unless you're a hipster and you really like can, you know, pull it off. It's full of rules and right angles and dust-free zones. It's not a ceramicist space.
Right.
It's, It's always like it's often in a basement and lacking any kind of nice light. And it's mechanical. I mean, that's it. That's what you're getting at, right? It's like mechanical more than like so many other mediums and media is like full of like mechanisms and rules and ratios and optics. And somehow you have to challenge that thing and then make this kind of beautiful, squishy, nebulous, you know, inspired work, hopefully, out of it. And so there's a lot you have to wrestle with, but yes, you have to know all the rules. You have to know how to expose film and pixels and
right.
how to make a print. And you can't just run at it willy-nilly like you can. I have to be careful because...
right. You don't have to say.
Really not me. but like you have to know the rules before you can break the rules. And,
right.
And you could say that of any medium, right?
So sure. I just yeah, absolutely. Book. I think that's a really good way of putting it. But I think to further sort of the investigation of this is you're talking about there's an inherent paradox in which the photographer, let's just call him or her ex-photographer, has all of these traits that allow him or her to, you know, keep all the right angles in their right angles and you know, and
right.
follow all the rules and be a little bit, you know, to use a slightly pejorative word, a little uptight in their sort of sensibilities, you know, that's kind of that's a benefit to being a successful straight photographer. And so the question is, if that's more the case than not with photographers, when you get to that point where you want to break the rules, then that becomes really challenging because then you're having to unlearn all of that tightness.
Yes. I don't know exactly how to respond to that because my instinct is you could say that about a lot of mediums.
Sure.
But I'm pretty buttoned up, like in general. But in my work, I have go-to subject matter. I have ways of working. I have a camera of choice. And within that, though, I have to say, and we can talk about my work later and some of the influence if you want, I do try to shake it up and keep it lively, but there are a lot of rules, and I have made peace with that. I have made peace with not trying to reinvent the way I work all the time, and I'm at a certain age where it feels okay to have certain habits and have certain rules. And just to touch upon students we were talking about or young artists, like often that doesn't feel as comfortable.
Right.
So I get that, but a lot of my friends that are photographers, and we are I keep saying buttoned up and conservative and rules, and you've said that a couple of times. Like, I don't want to portray myself as I don't wear a pocket protector.
Right.
Like I'm
sure.
I like to think I'm pretty cool on some level, but I'm not a wild kind of guy in
right.
a lot of ways. I like that in my friends and people in general, but most photographers I know lean toward being, you know, orderly.
Yeah, that's basically all I was getting at, you know, as far as the cliches, you know, and then as far as the challenge of sort of overturning that, which I think you made a good point that, you know, maybe certain other disciplines, there's a certain discipline that applies. But just to make it more specific, I imagine that you do your shoots based on what you've learned over a number of years. And, you know, there's a lot of ingredients that go into that. But at this point, when you print your works, do you outsource that or do you do it yourself?
Yeah, that's a good, I'm not sure how you want to run with some of this stuff. Like, I think it's a really interesting time to be a photographic artist. And especially one who's mid-career or whatever. I'm beyond mid-career now, whatever. But I learned photography back in the day when you had a traditional analog SLR camera and some Tri-X film with 24 exposures, and you had to make them count and process them correctly, and they were precious. And all of that was good and geeky, and it's changed. Everything and digital, the advent of digital came along, and I have a foot in that world as well. And so I love them both. I went into it kicking and screaming, the digital age. And I work in both now. I use a 4x5 inch negative, so large sheet film in one of those old time cameras that you use a dark cloth over your head. And
sure.
I don't know what if your listeners know much about photography, but it is like the quintessential old timey camera
and classic large format size film.
Yeah, so large format, and I still use that because I love it.
Right.
I used to, and this is maybe an interesting point for photographers to like. I used to say and believe. I think I believed it. That I still wanted to shoot film because it has a certain look and there's something about magical about the camera and it's the interaction with your subject because I shoot portraits. It's a conversation piece. It's an unusual camera. It's not like a high-end digital thing that's the camera of intrigue and espionage. It's that it mattered that it be that type of camera. I don't think that matters as much anymore. I think there are digital cameras that can get you pretty close.
Mm. And what is the digital camera that you use, by the way?
The digital camera that I use a film camera. I use a 4x5 analog film camera. Outside of that, I have a Nikon SLR, digital SLR that I use, and I have an iPhone. Those are my...
Right, that's okay.
Yeah,
so you don't use one of those digital Hasselblads or anything like that. You've got the standard.
No, I've used them, and sometimes certain companies will ask you to use the camera, and they let you, especially if I'm teaching a workshop. And I love them; they're amazing. But it's not the camera that I'm using right now for my work.
I see.
One day, if Kodak, they've taken so many things away from, like, if they stop making film, I will use a digital camera willingly, and hopefully my work won't change that much. But to back to your question, I shoot film, color film. I have it developed at a lab.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, the film is scanned by the same lab and rendered into really beautiful high-end files full of information.
How big is each photographic file, would you say?
I don't even know what the file, like hundreds and hundreds of beyond a TIFF file, like more than I need. And when I get the files, I break them down into TIFF file, 300 DPI TIFF files. But they do my printing as well, so they stay very large files, and you can make prints that are 50 by 60 without a, I mean, they look amazing.
Right, got it, okay.
So my work is both analog and digital, and the lab that I use in Boston, I use two labs. One is called Singer Editions, and the other one is called Color Services. One of the labs that I use a little bit more is called Color Services, and it's run by this wonderful guy by the name of Mark Elliott, and he is a photographer. I'm like, really, he understands analog photography, and he understands digital photography, and he oversees these prints that really are, although they're digital, have all of the outwardly, like, really have the look of what I love about film.
Mm.
So it really helps to have people who know how to print on your work if you're working with a lab.
And how many of the prints that he's doing generally are digital? You're saying that he's taking the digital files that have been converted from the film that you've shot, correct?
Yes, and then they're printed as archival pigment prints. They're printed as digital prints.
So I see. Got it.
They look great. They can do things on the computer that you can squeeze things out of these files that you never could in a million years. God rest the soul of Ansel Adams. Like, you just could never do what we can do today, you know?
So really, these prints, these digital prints, are better quality than if this guy were to print these on film instead?
Yes, for sure.
Got it.
For sure.
Right, okay. One of the things that's really interesting that we kind of touched on in our earlier calls is that you are teaching these workshops, and I was looking at your site, and you know, and you've got a, and you mentioned it as well, you know, you're doing it kind of all over the place, and I just wanted to look into, you know, how long those workshops last for, you know, what kinds of things that go on there that's different than, or in the workshops that's maybe different than when you are adjunct teaching, or is it pretty much the same thing?
Yeah, I actually leave next week, and a week from I don't know, in about a week, I'm leaving to go out to Colorado, to Aspen.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually Snowmass, Colorado, to the Anderson Ranch Art
right.
Center.
Right.
And it's a great place, but this is a place where you can take all a wide range of workshops, woodworking to painting to photography and video, and it's an amazing place in the mountains. And what's different about it is that it's short, and this sometimes they're 2 weeks. This one is a 1 week workshop where the course description is storytelling in photography. And what's fun and sometimes challenging about workshops is you have a super distilled amount of time, and the demographic of your class could be anyone from, you know, ladies of Aspen who garden and want to take pictures of flowers, and nothing wrong with that. But like, I've got to suddenly be able to talk at length about, you know, a snapdragon. And then occasionally you have graduate students who get a scholarship to come out. And so you have it's all over the place, young, old, rich, poor,
right.
Black, white, everything. And you have a week to kind of pull it together and hit this middle ground, and have a course description, and you're not grading these students. They're in it because they want to be there, and some more than others. And it's challenging and fun, and they don't have to come to class if they don't want to. And so a lot of the rules are kind of gone that are in an academic, you know, university. And so I love that. And I make my own work, too. I photograph as well when I'm at these places.
Are you photographing alongside your students?
I do. We'll do a couple of field trips, and I bring my camera, and it's actually been great. There are times that I go out and I'm photographing, and I'm like the Pied Piper. We're walking around. Talk about like the photo geeks. Like, we're all out there with our cameras, and you know, here come 20 tripods down the road in a dusty like town
right.
in Colorado.
Right.
But I've made some great work. And my students have made great work. We have a lot of fun, and it's always different every time. And it's hopefully the chemistry is good. You have a good group of people, and it's different everywhere. And then in August, I have another one here in Massachusetts in Provincetown, which is a very different, you know, kind of group of people. Usually,
that sounds awfully euphemistic. What kind of group
well,
of people
no,
are we talking
just,
about?
I wanted to not talk about red states, blue states, but it's like, you know, you cannot get any more liberal than Provincetown, Massachusetts,
right.
And so you have certainly LGBTQ. It's like it is like they are my people. Like so, it's a wide and but not completely, but it is. It does kind of fall into a different kind of group dynamic, and usually a lot of fun and different, and it's Provincetown, it's Cape Cod, a very different landscape, and it's also it's called the Fine Arts Work Center, and it's primarily mostly a writing program. So there's a lot of, you know, it's artists and writers all on one compound together, and it's really pretty magical.
One of the things that I remember, and I'd be interested to hear what your experiences have been with crits, but one of the things that I remember about being in photography class crits is that they had a very particular flavor to them, you know, because you could take a very, it would kind of be a mixture of the formal and the conceptual, you know,
but I
imagine that at a place like Provincetown, I don't know if you're doing crits at these workshops, but that could be, you know, maybe overly extended conversations, whereas at places like, you know, Snowmass or Anderson Ranch, rather, know, it could be kind of everything across the board.
Yeah, well, the kind of teacher that I am and the kind of workshops that I put together tend to be upper level workshops where it's less like, I don't want to be the guy nor am I the best guy to teach intro to Photoshop and learn to use your SLR. That will never be me. So I like to teach the upper level courses, which are about making work, talking about work, writing about your work. I talk a lot about the artist statement and how you actually get your work out there into the world, and how do you get organized as an artist? And so I have lots of advice on that, and we do little exercises in writing about your work. And I emphasize the critique. I think I give good crit, as I always say. Like, I think if I have a strength, I'm usually, I think by nature, a pretty humble guy. But I enjoy critique. I think that I create a comfortable atmosphere. I remember as a student, I always loved instructors who were usually artists as well, who had the ability to enter into a student's work on that student's on their particular terms.
Right.
Check your shit. Oh, I'm sorry. Your stuff.
You're allowed to swear on this show. This is
okay,
not FCC.
Sure. So check your stuff as much right. as possible, and listen to what that student wants, and do
right.
your best to, of course, have your opinions, but make sure you're doing what Tommy wants. You know, and you're talking about the work in a way that the student is actually interested in talking about the work.
Yeah.
And I do that, and I encourage the students. We actually talk about how does a critique work? How should we approach this? We should be critical. We don't need a pep rally. Let your parents do that. You know, so I talk about constructive criticism, and I talk about listening to what students want, have your opinions, and qualify, quantify. You're not allowed to say this is pretty. You have to say why it's pretty.
Right. Sure.
Or I don't like that. Well, why don't you like it? And so I make them crazy because it's kind of like a political debate. It's like there's just no escaping accountability to a certain extent. I try to make it pleasant, and I try to keep humor alive and well in it as well.
What about if it's, you know, more of a grad student type of situation where all of those things are already presumed, or understood.
Well, they're not always already presumed.
They're not always presumed, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I think you have to still, in a different way, hopefully use better vocabulary and, try to, you have to adjust for the age group and the level, but all those rules still apply, and you have to remind them. It's like, what are we talking about here? Can we, like, this student, this graduate, this second-year graduate student is about to graduate and go out into the world, and they don't have a clue as to what's really happening on this wall here or
right.
in this video or this sculpture. Let's be honest. The emperor is totally naked,
Do you feel like, David, when you have been in situations like that, let's say this fictional or specific unnamed, ungendered graduate student that you are in a crit with, and they are in their second year and they're about to, or third year and they're about to graduate, and they have that, missing data that are you thinking to yourself, how many of their former teachers completely dropped the ball or just, were just bad teachers?
Well, Michael, I can't believe you're saying, I think that all the time, and I want to be careful. I don't want to name schools, because
right.
it actually happens at a lot of schools, but,
right.
and it actually happens when I travel to, I'm sounding full of myself, and I'm not really, because
no,
I'm
you're
sure
not.
That I have, I'm
you're
sure
not
that
sounding
I've
full of yourself.
Involved with lots of students, but I often go and I'll visit a school in another state just as a visiting artist, and you do critiques often as part of that. And I find myself, it's like, really, nobody has said this about your work before? It's like, you're interested in talking about your mother as a hoarder, and this is like, and you're making these studio pictures of her against a white backdrop. Like, bring on the hoarding, or like,
right.
where are these? That's a stupid example, but I often feel like I need to call, and as we should with one another, it's our duty, I think, as people and as educators especially, to make sure that you don't let the student out into the world without a way to, it sounds awful, but like market their, like to without being able to understand their work fully. And how is anyone else going to enter into your world?
Right, right.
So
I wonder, I'm interested though, even on a more investigative or sort of micro level of this, I wonder if part of you is feeling like you want to go, scream at their photography teacher, at the school that you're visiting or whatever. Do you think comes down to, and maybe you've seen specifics about this, do you think it comes down to the old boy or old guard, of the tenured track people who don't deserve to be there kind of thing?
Yeah, often it does.
Mm-hmm.
both here at, in the Boston area and other places, that there are times that there are certain faculty that have been around for, that they are deeply embedded in their positions, and they've kind of lost touch with their students and their own work and what the zeitgeist, if you will, of
right.
any, like, of what's happening in photography is. And it is sometimes alarming, and I'm thankful that they have adjunct faculty there that are, like, fresh out of graduate school and kick-ass and every, like, know what they're talking about, and because they pick up the slack often. They are the unsung heroes of a lot of institutions, a lot
yeah.
of colleges.
Right, right. And you are a part of their ranks, in a sense.
I am now. I was for years a full-time teacher, and I made the choice to leave full-time teaching to be a full-time artist. And
right.
And depending on the year, I teach a little bit of adjunct. So there are semesters where I don't teach at all. But last year I was a full-time adjunct.
And where is this?
Massive, right? It's like I'm all of the work for none of the benefits. But it just worked out that way.
And I'm sorry, where was this?
Last semester it was at Massachusetts College of Art, where I actually did my undergraduate work.
Mm-hmm.
Had a great group of students there. With the seniors, and also over at Lesley University in Cambridge, Lesley University College of Art and Design, I should say. And I was working with seniors there and graduate students as like a visiting faculty.
And where was it that you were full-time?
I was at full-time at Yale University for 5 years.
Wow.
Were
you part of the Pitt? Crits?
I was part of the Pitt. Well,
okay.
I was a student. I went there. I received
okay.
my MFA from Yale.
Uh-huh.
So I was on that side of the table in the Pitt. And you should tell your the Pitt is.
Oh, we've talked. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
The Pitt was this room, the critique room, the crit room, if you will, that was literally a pit that you would walk down into, because it wasn't nerve-wracking enough that you had to show your work to this like power panel. But they put you in like this hole in the ground
right.
where there's no escape and no air. And now they have a new building at Yale, and it's a former pool. And it's still, they call it the pool or the crit, but it's another pit that you walk down into. So I went to Yale, and then years later, after some time out in the world, I went back and, taught there.
You were involved in the Pitt crits, and what,
yeah,
what years was
the
that?
Undergraduate mm. Photo, and I was on the graduate critique panel. I also was a part of the crit for the graduate students.
I'll sort of cut you off a little bit there before is because I had did an episode with a painter named Zach Smith who.
Oh, I know Zach.
He talked quite a bit in his episode about the pit because it sounded quite intense when he was there. It sounds
yeah.
like they've been both more and less intense, you know, in other years. But I mean, and one, I should say somebody who I will not mention, but who was a photographer, who maybe I'll mention her to you later, and maybe you know each other. But she had a really and a lot of people had a really. Horrendous experience with a very famous artist involved in a Instagram, photography episode. So just to give people a little specifics,
yeah.
But I don't know if you were involved in that. You probably weren't involved in that specifically, but did you?
I know of that. I
yeah.
know of that. But I've been involved in other scenarios. Not myself, as you know. I was always like the guy who, I don't know how to say it, but I was. On the critique panel with the graduate students, I was kind of low man on the totem pole when I was there.
Okay.
I joke. I was like Todd Papageorge, who was the then head of the department. I used to call myself in private like his Ed McMahon, who I was just like carefully laugh at all of the things that he said. And I love Todd, and he was great. And as a teacher, during my experience as a student, he was amazing.
Mm.
So I love Todd, but it was nerve-wracking because you always wanted to say and do the right thing. And so it was not only were the students wielding their words carefully and their work carefully, but it was a performance for us on the panel as well. It was very stressful.
Yeah.
It was great, I think, for a lot of the students. So I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth. But it was a lot of work and more work than it needed to be. But if you had a strong constitution and when I was a student there, I was there at the right time for me and my work and my the age that I was at, and I had an amazing MFA experience at Yale.
Mm-hmm.
Teaching there was a little bit more nerve-wracking. Being a student there was nerve-wracking, but totally inspiring, and I don't think there was any other program better for me personally when I was there.
One thing that I was kind of wondering or anticipating the direction that you might go when you were describing your experience being on one of the teachers there, kind of the lowest man on the totem pole, is like that if these students would have these traumatic experiences, you know, where they would essentially be chopped down into stubs by the big boys and girls on the faculty, that you would like afterwards go running after them and try to console them. Was that at all a scenario?
Some of them. I mean, I'm speaking in generalizations here. They would say you weren't. There's no big little man on the totem pole. But some of that's just my own baggage, probably. But I certainly was the guy who, because of my nature, maybe after it was over, I would, and the student was upset. I would often kind of help them pick up the pieces and kind of forensically kind of retrace what happened and find the positive notes. And I think that's just how I am, and some of the other faculty as well, of course. But I never like to be the guy to go and be the, you know, kick ass and then walk out to the pub across the street. Like I never felt good being that. Like the tough love thing doesn't always feel right for me.
Yeah, it sounded from the impressions that I've heard from a few different people talking about it, is that some of these teachers, including, you know, bad tenured ones, would basically use it as an opportunity to perform, you know, and it was really about more about their own egos than actually giving criticism to students' work.
Yeah, it is. And I would say, out of fairness to I think every critique panel that I've ever been on, even this past semester, there is a level of performance that the faculty is. We're all trying to say the smart thing, and I'll just admit it, and other people would say no, but it is a performance. Like, you always, I think, you know, because it's public, and you want to help the student, but you're also you want to say something that is going to be meaningful and helpful for the student, and maybe performance is the wrong word. It's very self-aware.
Right.
You know? And I think just by my personal nature, like, I am that kind of person. I police myself very carefully. And so I know that when I'm in a critique, I'm not fully the David Hillier that I am when I'm in other places.
Right.
But maybe that's how it is for everyone.
When you were a little while back to switch gears again here, you use this example of the student with the mother, you know, as a hoarder, and this is going to be kind of an awkward segue, but I did want to. It was the point where I thought, oh, we need to talk about you and your dad, you know, because your father has been in poor health for a while, and if I recall right, correct me if I'm wrong, you and your brother have been spending a lot of time with him.
You know, I have made a lot of my work is self-referential. So I make work about my identity, about my sexuality, my family life. But I should also say for viewers and listeners that don't know my work, I like to think that the work is open-ended and that people can project their own histories onto it to a certain extent. But a lot of the work has been about my father, you know, lower middle class, like working class guy, you know, Navy man. And for years I was always have been interested and close with my father, of course, but really wanted to elevate a type of guy who was under-recognized in society in general.
Mm.
And who happens in this case also to be my father, who has always championed me for the oddball that I am and is a bit odd himself. And so over the years I've been documenting him. And it begs the question now, as a guy who's 84 years old and in failing health and now in a nursing home, it'll be a year next month that he went into a nursing home, when do you stop photographing? And when do you, like, you never stop being the son, you're there to the end, but I'm still, like, making work about it, and I never thought I wanted to be the guy making photographs in a nursing home.
Right. But and have you been?
I have been, yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, not only am I photographing him there a little bit, it's not so easy sometimes because he's like I said, he's in tough, his health is precarious and he has some dementia, and it's not always easy to go in and like set up a photo shoot, but it's often a nice distraction for him, and things will happen that suddenly feel narrative and poetic and not like your typical photograph of like an elder in a nursing home in a way that I already know, and like something feels kind of more poetic about it or
right.
something. So I look for those moments and I often capture them. I go back and they happen again because a lot of things happen again in nursing homes. It's like Groundhog Day often.
It seems like it's both. It seems like this is a way to put a really positive spin on it. It's both a way for you to spend more time with him and
yeah.
to be also, you know, hopefully not in an exploitive way, or this doesn't sound exploitive, but also, you know, making your art at the same time, essentially.
Yeah. It's actually amazing. Like, it has been such an education for me. Here I am at my age, and I have learned things about myself and about the elderly and about my studio practice. And it's been really exciting. It's I love going to the nursing home. Not always, but like I do when I go there, I check all of my stuff at the door, and I know everyone's name, and I learn a lot, and it's fun. And yes, sometimes it's hard, and people have passed, and that's really hard. It's inspiring sometimes. A quick little story is I went in there once and I was talking to the woman who's the activities director, who's about my age. And as I'm talking to her, I look on her computer screen and I see a picture of my father as her desktop screensaver. And he's got like a crown on his head, and he's dressed in this like Mardi Gras regalia. And it turns out that unbeknownst to me, a few days ago, they had a Mardi Gras party and contest for the king and queen, and my father was elected king.
Mm.
And there was a queen, and they dressed them up and they rolled them down the hall of the nursing home on some like rolling table. And I had talked to my father for 3 days since then. He never said anything about it, and he was a little bit embarrassed that he was drinking the Kool-Aid of the nursing home. He was actually having fun there.
Right.
He was popular.
And didn't you go back and reshoot the King and the Queen?
I went back, yeah. I had to get the permission of the Queen, Betty. I had
right.
to get her family's permission because she also had some cognitive dementia. And I made this really wonderful portrait of the two of them in their King and Queen, and people watched, and the activities directors closed off the dining room so I could make the picture. And, you know, they don't get that every day, you know, and it's like I make work. My father and I like continue to grow closer with our kind of fun kind of thing we have together, making pictures together. And I think the residents got a kick out of it.
Right.
I'm careful that I don't think I'm in my work in general exploiting anyone. There's negotiations that happen. There's permission that you ask for. And there's been a lot of stuff like that going on. I'm going to be making, my father likes to get his hair cut way too often, like it's just something to do. And so I'm making a picture of that. There's a term called furniture walking, which is when somebody an elder doesn't want to use a walker. They're too proud to maybe use a cane or a walker.
Right.
When my father first went there, he was a furniture walker, meaning that he would get up from his chair and basically throw himself from piece of furniture to piece of furniture. Rather than be humiliated by using a cane, but he would like jump around throwing himself from chair to table. And and so I made a picture of my father's called Furniture Walking, and it's a triptych. It's three separate photographs that join together, but it's him in the middle kind of holding himself up. And then the other photographs, the flanking photographs, it's his hands reaching in. So it's multiple Ray Hilliards kind of grasping around in the space.
It sounds like the work that you've been doing at the nursing home is the most concentrated place for releases, you know, permissions. Is permission something that you've had to deal with much before that or not really?
No, there's not a lot of permission because it's mostly just pointed at my father. And the only other, like, I photographed Betty, and who sadly has since passed away. I had to get permission from her family. And so, yes, I ask, and I have to make sure that I'm not in the way of a bingo event that's happening or happy hour. And so there's a lot of rules, and I quickly could become inconvenient if I don't follow them.
Sure.
So.
What about with the to go back to pre, you know, nursing home work or non nursing home work? You appear to work with. I'm trying to figure out if some of your models are models or are people that you somehow came across because you live near them or whatever, or were doing a residency maybe in a place where they were. What would you say the majority of them are, models?
The majority are people that I know, my community, often gay and lesbian. My family. My parents are divorced. My mother is the opposite of my father in every way. Mm-hmm. My mother is a born again Christian who lives in Southwest Florida and is remarried. So I photograph her and her world there. So there are no models involved in any of that. And then I photograph a lot of strangers.
I think that's who I'm talking about, the young men series.
Yeah, a lot of young men. And
do you pay them?
You are shameless. Yeah,
No. I didn't mean in that way. I just meant as models.
No, I do. I do. What I don't do, and let me just preface, like, what I don't do, unless I have to because I've been hired by, like, an editorial thing or a fashion thing, I don't seek out, like, professional models.
Sure.
But what I do, what I love are people that are interesting for whatever reason, and we can talk about that, out in the world, that some of them are beautiful and could be models, but they are regular people who I photograph. And, yes, sometimes I give them money.
Sure.
Not often. More often than not, no. I offer to give them prints. I get an address, and I send them prints or a digital file. But sometimes, like, somebody won't do anything unless maybe they get a little money. Or I made a photograph once, and I had, like, it cost me a six-pack of Bud Light. You know,
right.
It's like I got to buy somebody a six-pack. So there's often a transaction that has to happen.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to make too big deal about it. They seem very, for the most part, if not completely, they're all very flattering. So it's the kind of, you know, interaction where you would definitely not need to pay them.
But I do worry about being exploitative, and I've never ever used model release forms. I like to think that I hope that I'm making photographs that are flattering, empowering, that capture the spirit of who the person is, and that I don't use them in a way that is counter to who they are. Because I title my work, I try to keep it in line with who that person is or I perceive them to be.
Right. Right.
So I have really never had a problem. I have made pictures that I then show the person, and they say, "Oh, I'd rather not. I look fat, or I don't like myself in that picture," and you don't use it.
Sure.
That's it.
Very
and
fair.
What is true is that, you know, out in the world, when you're asking people, it's often, and I say this to students, they're terrified to go up to somebody and say, "Can I take your picture?" It's kind of a wonderful thing to ask somebody, you know? It's not like you say, you're not going up and saying, can I touch your ass? You know, you just want to look at them. And so they just say no. And, but we're often very fearful to ask somebody if we can acknowledge them. And, many people are flattered by it.
Sure. But that said, it would you say that procedure of, you know, asking strangers to pose for you is something that happens kind of on a regular ongoing basis or pretty infrequently?
No, I do it a lot. I mean, I'm going off to teach these workshops. I will be asking many strangers if I can photograph them. I will be rejected countless times.
Okay.
And I think, percentage-wise, I will be allowed more often than not to make the picture. Most people will, but you get people who say no. They want to know what is the photograph for, and we don't even need to have the post 9/11 conversation. Like, people are just suspicious of one another in a really deeper, darker way.
The thing that I'm interested in is have you developed a thicker skin having done this for so long?
I wish that I could say yes. No, I still am shy by nature, and I'm often my own worst enemy, and I often use the story of once being in Alaska, of all places, circling this father and son who were fishing for salmon, and I mean, I ended up making a beautiful picture of them called Hope, and it wasn't until the father kind of finally looked at me. I must have been annoying. I was like a fly circling them. He's like, "Do you want to take our picture?" Because I had my camera over my shoulder.
Right.
The kid was loud, and I was like, I wasted like a lot of time and some good light with my circling and my fear, and like the father's like, "Take our picture, you know."
Wow.
Do it.
Right.
Yeah, and that's right. Not unusual for me. It's like sometimes I get in my head. And so I actually, when I tell students about this, it's like, I have to practice what I'm preaching right now, because fear is something you've got to challenge.
Well, so when you're going to be doing it, you know, this summer, at the various destinations you're going to be at, do you now have a sort of practice routine that you go through so that you, will minimize, you know, the circling around?
Not really. No. No, it's always different, and I kind of like it. And
you like the torture of being uncomfortable and pushing yourself?
Yeah, I kind of like it. Sounds like it's actually kind of exciting, the fear, like the kind of excitement of it's like hunting. I'm going to go out and I'm going to find somebody, and I try to, as much as possible, embrace the unknown. Like, I am going to go out. I'm going to make a picture today, and I like the hunt. I do.
Right.
There is a little bit of fear in it, but there's also some excitement. Oh, and I should say this, and it's full disclosure here, is I often, not always, I often try to bring an assistant with me, and it could be a student. It often could be a paid assistant, and I try to bring the opposite of me. Meaning often female, often outgoing, just like to cover the bases, just to double our chances that people are going to be comfortable. Because there's something about like a guy alone,
right.
Middle-aged guy alone,
right.
With a camera, but a guy with like a young person, or it sounds, I have to choose my words carefully, but often a young woman,
sure.
Who is pleasant, and that sets some people, for whatever reasons, at ease, and it's very helpful to have an assistant for obvious
sure.
reasons as well.
So they're going to become the model handler, essentially, so that
a little bit
you
times,
can facilitate
and like,
it.
And maybe
yeah.
help me, but there are times when I'm setting up this sometimes cumbersome camera and struggling with light and location
right.
to get the picture right. And there, the model is often feeling awkward, and the assistant and I will talk about this in advance, saying, "Your job is like, can you make sure that you keep the person comfortable?"
Right.
And so they often will be chit-chatting while I'm trying to figure out the best way to expose or
right.
shoot or frame.
Right.
Yeah.
That makes complete sense. Yeah.
So that's maybe to your point, that's it, to limit, you know, minimize the collateral damage of like being underprepared.
So. Right. Yeah. Got it. So you have this house that you've been building over quite a lot. I feel like we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about your house.
Yeah.
And it's in the middle of Maine, correct?
It's in Western Maine. So it's Maine is
middle of nowhere, Maine, I should say.
It's nowhere, Maine.
Yeah.
It's really, you go to Portland, Maine, which is up the coast. It's a couple of hours from Boston, right on the coast. And then you drive about an hour northwest.
Okay.
And it's just before you squeak back into New Hampshire. It's right, it's not far from the border of New Hampshire. So it's called the foothills. It's the lake district of Maine. So small mountains and lakes.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people think of Maine as the beautiful coast that it is, but it also has tons of national forest and beautiful lakes and mountains. And
and how did you choose that area to settle in?
Well, I grew up, my grandfather had a place in southern New Hampshire, so obviously not as far up, but I always liked going further north. And it made sense that the further north you go, especially into Maine, you can get a lot of land for less money. And so with a friend, we bought a very nice piece of land and slowly built a house.
But it's not done, or is it done?
It's done. It's done, and we just keep adding to it. So it's a newer version of one of these old farmhouses with all these L's and outbuildings. But we're done. Trust me, we are done after this. We're in the last little building project, and it's going to be done.
And how long has it been going on?
Since 2002.
Okay.
we bought 200 acres, which a lot of it not buildable, like mountains.
Right.
And like it's very, but a lot of it really beautiful. It was former, it was land that had been logged probably in the 1930s or 40s. And it just had an old trail that went into it, which eventually became the driveway. We sited a spot that had a beautiful view. We cleared about 2 acres of the land, and so we have these smaller kind of pastures, and built a really nice, very simple house and made a few additions to it, and it's pretty great. It really is a place where life can imitate art as much as anything else.
Like, right. You know. And you can spend time there in the warmer months, basically, when you have time off? Is that the idea?
Year round. I go up there, up there last weekend, and it's fully winterized, and it's about 3.5 hours from here. So it's not a place you go for just one day. You know, you definitely have to commit to a couple nights to make it pleasant. But it's great. I go up there and I work a lot because we're always working on the property, but I photograph a little bit there. It's not a place that I actually make a ton of work. I usually am doing other things up there. But I love nature. I'm a big birder. I feed birds and, hike a lot, snowshoe in the wintertime, cook great meals. And, it is this thing that is, important in my life. I was talking to you earlier before this about wearing a lot of hats in my life.
Right.
I am an artist. I teach, but I also, like everyone, I guess, but I'm also equally interested in nature and going to Maine and doing these other things that are my career doesn't dominate my life. For some people, probably as much as it should.
Right.
Like, I have a lot of distraction.
Do you have guests up there, or will you?
I do. Yes.
Okay.
All the time. Not like big groups of people, but I have friends come up and family, and it's really wonderful to entertain there. And,
it sounds lovely.
Yeah. So that happens a lot, but it is a place for me to go to decompress, and more than I really. It's funny coming from my upbringing, and it's more than I ever thought I could have. It's really pretty great, and it sounds trite, but it's true. I'm very much aware that this land is mine for a little while, and there's a stewardship that's happened. Like, I treat it nice, and I know that this will go to someone else in the future, and it really is a gift to have it right now, and I really feel it when I'm there.
And you mentioned your friend earlier. So the two of you bought it together and built it together, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
And do you work out if you should both show up at the same time? That's fine.
Well, my friend is actually at the time when I bought the property, he was my partner, and we are still the best of friends, but we're no longer partners. So we go up there. We both have our own spaces. We are almost 99% of the time we go up there together. He's my best friend. We
talk about an amicable breakup.
It was really good. And it continues. We own the house in Boston together, and we call ourselves Prens, which is hybrid partner friends. As breakups go, it's been one of the best I've ever had. So people say, you're crazy. You're living with your ex-boyfriend. It's like, yeah, it's like you should be so lucky to have this friendship that I have.
Right.
So don't judge me for that.
The rules
don't apply, really, if it's working, if you're getting along with someone.
One of the things that I was thinking about when we were talking about your work earlier is that, you know, your work, when we were talking about the sort of photography, you know, niche versus art, sort of the way they distinguish themselves, you show with this gallery, Yancey Richardson, right, in New York, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's pretty much exclusively a photographer's gallery.
Yeah, almost exclusively. And in Boston, the gallery I show with is more of an art gallery that shows some photographers and a lot of painting and sculpture and installation. And so I show with a range of different types of galleries, which I kind of like.
Yeah, okay. So you have more.
But I should say this about my work is, although I am, and you have mentioned it, like a photographer's photographer, I am a straight photographer. Like, I love photography. My work is totally photographic. But if your listeners like look at my work, the work itself, although photographic, has a long history. Like, my first love in art was theater. So there's performance involved. Mm. I was a film major, so the films joined together sequentially in a filmic way. I read a lot. I love a lot of fiction. So there's storytelling involved. And I think all of that stuff really matters. And so although it, and I think of my work as a hybrid, or certainly a confluence of a lot of different influences. So right. It ends in photography seems to be the best mediation of many of my interests.
Yeah. I remembered another thing that occurred to me, because when I was looking at your work, you know, and seeing the additions, I was thinking of sort of making this initially, and I still can, a market question about how photography has done, you know, kind of with its explosion, you know, in the market. But I actually, instead of going down that road, I'd be more interested just to ask the sort of practical question of, when you have a show, you know, with works in an edition of 6 or 7, does that automatically translate to a more lucrative exhibition experience, or is that a myth?
At least in my case, my editions, I print in 2 different sizes. You know, I have a large size, 30 by 40 panels, like large photographs, and then 20 by 24, and obviously different price point. And they are editions. And my editions are pretty large. One edition is at 12, and the other edition is at 7. And both say, so you could say that's a lot of pictures. That's a lot of copies of one image. But I work with lots of galleries, and my price point is fairly low compared to some artists. So I would rather keep my work affordable and have more editions than to make an edition of 3 and they're gone to a very select wealthy group of people. That has been my strategy, and it's not completely unique, but because of that, young collectors can afford my work. I can work with 5 different galleries, one in Europe and then 4 in this country. And have enough work to go around, and young collectors can afford it, institutions can buy it, and it's been working for me. So, and it's not always lucrative. Sometimes some work does better than others work, but, you know, I make a living. And
well, there you go. It's both a combination of you being able to get a pretty, you know, pretty decent compensation for let's say, one given image, you know, that's an addition of that many, you know, for different sizes. But at the same time, you're also wanting to make it as accessible to as low a price point of potential collectors as possible.
Yeah. I mean, it helps everyone. It helps me because I get to have work and I get to, you know, exhibit it more fully, and it's more affordable. And so, and don't get me wrong, like, not every photograph I make, I mean, some of them sell out, but lots of them never, like, there are a lot of, you know, a lot of the photographs that I make in my mother's Christian community, and no one touches those. Like, I make a lot of work that really just stays fully in addition.
Right.
But it's work that I need to make. And then I make other work that is arguably more, quote unquote, beautiful. It looks better over the sofa. And that stuff does great. So. But ultimately, you have to make the work that you have to make, and I tell this to my students as well. So
right.
Listen to your voice.
And if you, let's just say, for the sake of argument, if you have a show or a year of shows where the work does sell particularly well, how do you translate that income? You know, do you just put it into, have you in the past put it straight into the house building, or is it a miscellaneous mixed bag of things?
It is. I made a body of work in 2012, 2013, a body of work called The Tale is True. It was a father-son story that took place on Cape Cod, a father and his son, and their, you know, it's a complicated story. But it did surprisingly well, and really kind of, I thought it was kind of grim and a little bit sad, the work. And but I was during Paris Photo in Paris, and like they sold the pants off of that work like really fast at like one art fair. Like a lot of them almost went out of edition, and it doesn't happen a lot. And that was at a really good time for me because I actually did have a lot going on. So a lot of that did go into, some of it goes right back into the studio practice, but a lot of it went back into like building this crazy house in Maine. And but there are lean years, and there are some years where something remarkable happens, and you just have to keep the faith, right? It's like, and that's what I try to do.
Sure. David, it's been great. Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. I meant it when I first met you over the phones. Like I love your podcast. I, you know, have listened to a lot of them, and so when I was asked, it was I'm flattered. And
well, fantastic. Thanks so much again, David. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a pleasure speaking with you, and thanks for inviting me to be a part of the show.
Absolutely, it's great to have you.
All right,
have a good night.
You too. Bye.
Bye bye.
Thank you so much again to David Hilliard, who's been a mensch, and I look forward to hearing what your various students have to say about this episode, among others, David. So I'm sure you and they will keep us apprised. Thank you also to Chris Ford, who has been helping me on the podcast for a little while now, who connected David and I. Thank you, Chris. This is the time in the show where we remind you that this is a listener-supported show, meaning please support the show in any way that you can. Donations are extremely appreciated and helpful in this small enterprise. I do have both Chris Ford and Cooper Lovano helping me in their respective ways with the show. I would love to give a little bit of change to them, and that can come from your donation. So if you go to conversationpod.com/support, you can make an easy donation to this show. It's much appreciated. If you like the show, please show your support. You can, of course, also support the show by spreading the word, letting more people know about it, and leaving a very nice review on iTunes, which is linked through the website. And, of course, you can follow the show on social media, at Artist Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. And you can like the show on Facebook, also linked through the site, where soon we will finally have a 1,000th fan, and that person, like I have been teasing, has potentially the eligibility to get a trip to the Caribbean, I think is my go-to selection, you know, based on all the donations for Caribbean trips that have been coming in. All right, thank you very much for being here. I appreciate your listening. I appreciate your downloading. I look forward to hearing what you have to say about this and other episodes, and some of the ones that have been recently brought out from the archive into your stream, so do let us know about those as well. Thank you so much. I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.